So we just rewatched the entirety of this interview that we're about to play with Robert Kennedy Jr. And to be completely honest, the first couple of minutes, if you're not used to the way his voice sounds, you can think to yourself, well, I'm having trouble understanding this. Our strong advice to you is to keep listening. It is worth it. There's a lot in here, and you should hear all of it. Welcome to Tucker Carlson. Today, our next guest, Robert Kennedy Jr., doesn't need much of an introduction. He's been familiar to most Americans for a very long time. I would just add two things. One, he is one of the bravest, most impressive people I personally have ever met. And two, he is a remarkable journalist. 20 years ago, when his first cousin, Michael Skakel, was convicted of murder and sentenced to 20 years to life, Bobby Kennedy Jr. wrote maybe one of the great magazine pieces of all time, 2003, in The Atlantic, convincing many skeptics, including the one now speaking, that actually this was a miscarriage of justice, effectively proving his cousin's innocence in that case against a surging tide of media opposition. That rarely happens in journalism, and it suggested a kind of rigor of thinking and intensity and commitment to the facts that he has brought to his latest book. And that's the subject of today's interview. The book is called The Real Anthony Fauci, Bill Gates, Big Pharma, and the Global War on Democracy and Public Health. We are honored to have Bobby Kennedy Jr. in the studio with us today. Bobby, thanks so much for coming on.
Tucker, thanks so much for having me.
So, I mean, this is the question I think everyone asks when they first read about you. You know, why would you do something like this? You're well known. You could spend the rest of your life just, I don't know, being feted by famous people. There's absolutely no reason to stick your finger in the eye of the people who run the country by writing a book like this, but you did it anyway. Why?
Well, I think, you know, what's happened in this country over the last year, this kind of this bizarre imposition of totalitarian controls, the deconstruction of the Constitution, you know, the rise of censorship, the rise of the suppression of kind of religious freedoms, of property rights, closing a million businesses without just compensation or due process, the abolition of jury trials, which are guaranteed by the Sixth and Seventh Amendment for any vaccine company that hurts you. All of these, and the rise of kind of track and trace surveillance state, has been troubling to people, both Democrats and Republicans. People who support vaccines, people who oppose them, are looking at this and wondering what's happened. And I felt like I was in a unique position to interpret and to explain to people what had happened. I've been working, you know, as an environmental lawyer for 40 years, so I understand all of these mechanisms of corporate capture by which regulatory agencies assert control over regulated industries assert control over the agencies that are supposed to regulate them and essentially turn them into sock puppets. And I've been working on vaccine issues since 2005. And the kind of regulatory capture that you see in that space is really capture on steroids, because these agencies, FDA gets 45% of its budget from vaccine companies, from industry.
May I pause? The FDA gets 45% of its budget from vaccine companies?
Pharmaceutical companies. And it's as if EPA got half of its budget from the coal companies, if you can imagine what the I spent probably 20% of the lawsuits, of the hundreds of lawsuits that I bought as an environmental lawyer, were against EPA for sweetheart, our arrangements for giving permits to oil companies, et cetera, that were illegal. And if you can imagine how much worse that capture would be if half of EPA's budget came from oil and coal companies, that's what you're dealing with in the pharmaceutical space. Not only that, CDC, which is another one of the HHS sub-agencies, spends $4.9 billion annually of its $12 billion budget buying and distributing vaccines. So it's really a vaccine company. It's not a regulatory agency. That's about 40% of its budget. NIH, CDC has vaccine patents. So the vaccines that it's pushing, it has 57 vaccine patents. is making royalties on. NIH has thousands of patents, many of them for vaccines. For example, Tony Fauci's agency owns half the Moderna patent and stands to make billions and billions of dollars on sales of the Moderna vaccine. Four of Tony Fauci's top aides also have patent rights to Moderna. So Tony Fauci can assign patent rights to his favored, you know, loyalists within his agency. And they then get to keep $150,000 a year for the rest of their lives on a product they're supposed to be regulating. Tony Fauci owns patents on drugs that he has developed. And so it's, you know, the regulatory function has been essentially subsumed by the commercial and mercantile aspects of vaccine production and vaccine manufacturing and vaccine uptake. And if you, within HHS, the way that you get promotions and raises and, you know, salary bonuses, et cetera, is by contributing to the crusade for vaccine uptake. You do not get promoted for finding problems with vaccines. And that's actually what we as a taxpayer are paying these regulators to do, but they're not doing it. And so I had kind of a unique perspective on what was happening at the beginning of 2020 and, you know, was able to kind of predict how they were going to handle this, how they would suppress. I've watched Tony Fauci. I've known Tony Fauci for years.
You know Fauci personally.
Yeah, I've met Fauci personally, but my family has these deep entanglements with these health agencies. My, you know, my uncles literally wrote the legislation that created a lot of these agencies. My Uncle Teddy, for 50 years, was the chair of the health committee, so he was writing the budgets for, you know, Tony Fauci and Francis Collins and all these agencies for a year. Some of the key institutions within NIH and HHS are named for members of my family, Una Shriver, my grandmother, Rose Kennedy. And, you know, we've had these deep entanglements. So I know Tony Fauci, but I also am very conscious of the fact that these officials really do not do public health so much as pharmaceutical production. Tony Fauci has transformed NIH into an incubator for pharmaceutical products. So he's supposed to be doing what Congress intended him to do, is to try to track the etiology of allergic diseases and chronic diseases and infectious diseases, and then figure out, do the kind of science we need to stop those diseases. There's been, since he came in 1968, we've gone from about 6% of Americans having chronic disease to, by 2006, 54%. What do I mean by what do I mean by chronic disease? There's three major categories, and then obesity. But one is neurodevelopmental diseases: ADD, ADHD, speech delay, language delay, tics, Tourette syndrome, narcolepsy, ASD, and autism. If you're my age, I'm 67 years old. I never heard of any of those diseases when I was a kid, and I didn't know anybody. I've been around. I was at the spear tip of working with people with intellectual disabilities. My family started Special Olympics. I never saw an autistic kid prior to 1989. I still don't know a single person my age who has full-blown autism. And by that, I mean nonverbal, non-toilet trained, head-banging, stimming, toe-walking. In my generation, it's about 1 in 10,000 who have autism. In my kids' generation, according to CDC, it's 1 in every 34, 1 in every 22 boys. Tony Fauci's job is to figure out why that happened. And when Congress said to EPA...
Those are amazing statistics.
When Congress said to EPA, tell us what year the autism epidemic began, EPA scientists came back and said 1989. Oh, but 1989 was also, they said there's a red line that year. And 1989, a lot of other stuff started, like food allergies. I didn't know, I had 11 siblings and about 70 first cousins. I didn't know anybody with a food allergy. Peanut allergy? Why do 5 of my kids have food allergies? Eczema, the allergic. You have a neurodevelopmental disease. You have the allergic disease, like asthma, eczema, anaphylaxis, food allergies, peanut allergies, all the food allergies exploded beginning in 1989. And then the last category is autoimmune diseases, like rheumatoid arthritis, juvenile diabetes. I didn't know anybody with diabetes when I was a kid. Today, there's diabetic kids in every classroom. There's about 70 autoimmune diseases that have become, at some level, epidemic since 1989. Tony Fauci's job is to tell us where they're coming from. We know it has to be an environmental toxin because genes do not cause epidemics. They may provide a vulnerability, but you need an environmental toxin. And there's a limited number of them. There's a guy called Phil Langigan, who's a very famous toxicologist in New York, and he looked at this cascade of chronic disease that began, you know, in the beginning of the 1990s. And he looked at the timing for exposures to certain environmental toxins, and he came down out with about 11 of them. And he said, you know, essentially it has to be one of these because they're the only ones that became ubiquitous across all populations. You had the same impact on Cuban children in Key Biscayne, Miami, and Inuit kids in Homer, Alaska, all at the same time. What could that be? It could be glyphosate, which is, you know, the product in Roundup, which became ubiquitous around that time. It could be neonicotinoid pesticides. It could be PFOAs, which is a flame retardant, which also became ubiquitous. It could be cell phones. It could be Wi-Fi. It could be ultrasound. He comes out with about 11 of those. But one of the key suspects has to be vaccines, because the vaccine schedule, you know, we went from having 3 vaccines I took when I was a kid, when I was fully compliant, to the 72 doses of 16 vaccines that our kids now are mandated to take if they want to stay in the school. And that really began, it began in 1986 when they passed the Vaccine Act and gave complete shield from liability to all vaccine companies, so that if you're a vaccine company and you injure somebody, no matter how grievous the injury, no matter how reckless your conduct, no matter how negligent you were, no matter how toxic the ingredient, nobody can sue you. So there's no depositions, there's no discovery, there's no class actions, and there's no incentive for you to make that product safe.
May I ask, is there any other manufacturer, distributor, is there any other product that has that kind of liability protection?
There is liability protection. There's a cap with nuclear power plants. And that's called the Price-Anderson Act. At Congress, you know, the insurance company wouldn't insure them, which was the problem with the jab vaccines. It wasn't a bunch of hippies who looked at the vaccines and said they're dangerous. It was the insurance companies who said, you are too dangerous for us to insure. And Pfizer, what happened is, Pfizer, which was then called Wyeth, had a product in the early 80s when they started ramping up vaccines, and it was a diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccine, a DTP vaccine. They knew that there was an injury rate because people started reporting injuries, but CDC was telling the world it was 1 in a million serious injuries. Their internal documents show that they believed it was 1 in 15,000 who got permanent brain injury or death. And but then they NIH and Wyeth and UCLA funded a study at UCLA where they really did a controlled study, and they immediately found it was 1 in every 300 kids. The result of that Pfizer, Wyeth at that time was saying, we are paying $20 in downstream liability for every dollar we're making in profit. They went to the Reagan administration and to the Democrats in Congress. This was, you know, everybody was at fault here. And they said, if you don't give us blanket freedom from liability, we are going to stop making vaccines and you will be out of a vaccine supply. So Congress passed and Reagan signed. Everybody was reluctant to do it. And like Reagan actually said to the companies, why don't you just make the vaccine safe? And why?
Good question.
And why is that? Because vaccines are unavoidably unsafe. And that phrase, unavoidably unsafe, is in the preamble to the Vaccine Act. And it is also part of the Supreme Court case in Berkowitz that essentially codified, that gave legal sanction, Berkowitz, that gave legal sanction to, to the freedom from liability. So once that happened, there was a gold rush because the vaccine companies said, holy cow, now we've got a product that is free from the biggest cause for every other medical. Every medicine kills somebody. You know, there's vulnerable subgroups. So, and it is, for most medicines, it's their biggest cost, paying those liabilities. So now the company said, holy cow, now we're completely free from that cost. They also, vaccines are the only company, the only product that never has to be safety tested. And the reason for that, it's an artifact of the CDC's legacy as the public health service, which was a quasi-military agency. That's why people at the CDC have military ranks like Surgeon General and they wear uniforms. And because it always had, the health agencies are very closely aligned with the military. And the vaccine program was conceived as a national security defense against biological attacks on our country. So they wanted to make sure that if the Russians attacked us with anthrax or some other biological agent, we could quickly formulate a vaccine, distribute it to 200 million American civilians with no regulatory impediments. And so they said, if we call this a medicine, we're going to have to test it like you test medicines, which is usually a five-year placebo-controlled, randomized, double-blind study. And you do it for 5 years because many medicine injuries have long incubation periods or long diagnostic horizons. So you need that long period of time to really make a cost-benefit analysis. Over the long term, are you saving lives? They said, we can't afford to do that. So their solution was, we won't call it a medicine. We'll call it a biologic, and we'll exempt biologics from safety testing. Now, none of the 72 vaccines that is currently mandated for our children has ever been safety tested against a placebo in preclinical trials. I made that statement for many years, and Tony Fauci said that I was wrong. I met with Tony Fauci in 2016 and Francis Collins with somebody from the Trump White House present. And I was with Del Bigtree and Aaron Seary and Lynn Redwood, who's a nurse practitioner. And I made that, I reiterated that statement to them. There's never been a single preclinical trial of randomized controlled placebo testing for any of the 72 vaccines. They said in front of the White House Observer, you're wrong. And I said to them, and show me one. I knew they didn't exist, unless they had them locked in a safe, because I had asked for them on freedom of information requests and they hadn't been able to produce them. So they just said, we're wrong, we'll get them to you. And they never did. It's the last I heard from them. So we sued them, Dell and Aaron and me, for ICANN. We sued them, and after a year in 2017, after a year of litigation, HHS came back and said, you're right, we've never done any. So nobody knows the risk profile for any of those vaccines. So nobody can tell you with a scientific certainty whether any of those products are causing more deaths and injuries than they're averting. People say, I'm anti-vaccine. I'm not. I'm pro-science and pro-safety testing. If there's a vaccine that is shown to work in a preclinical or in a randomized placebo-controlled trial, I 100% would support it. And by work, I mean that after 5 years, the vaccinated cohort is healthier than the unvaccinated cohort. That's really what we need to know.
So can I ask you a question? Can I ask you a question? You are effectively defending science, the scientific method, the free inquiry that's the basis of science. I couldn't agree with you more. At the beginning of this whole thing, I asked the obvious question about the VAERS numbers. Like, what? Every medicine kills somebody. That is demonstrably true. Advil kills people. So, like, what's the harm, demonstrated harm of this vaccine?
Nobody wants to
ask that question. Nobody wants to hear it posed. People become hysterical on both sides if you ask that question. What, you've been borne the brunt of that hysteria for years. What is that about? What's the psychology that leads people to say, I don't want to know about the downside?
Well, let me talk, because you mentioned the VAERS number. The VAERS is a vaccine adverse event reporting system.
Yes.
What the HHS rationale is that, yes, we didn't do adequate safety trials. They're abbreviated and they're abbreviated. They're too short to actually do safety trials. But if there are, and they were stratified and there weren't certain age groups, you don't know what the risk factor is, really know what the risk factor is for older people. It turns out if you're over 70, your risk from COVID are 1,000 times greater than if you're under 70. And that's really important when you craft public health policy to have that kind of information, right? Because your strategy for children should be completely different than your strategy from adults. They didn't have that kind of stratification in that study where you could look at each of those cohorts and make those kind of, you know, calculations. What the HHS and the public health agency said is, we will figure that out post-licensing if we will start giving these vaccines to millions of people. And we will then see if people are harmed. The problem is the system, the surveillance system that they have, which is the only one that, you know, that they've had for years, the vaccine adverse event reporting system. Now, the vaccine adverse event reporting system, which we'll call VAERS, has collected a humongous number of injuries. It's a voluntary system, so the doctor or somebody injured has to call in, and it takes about 30 minutes to make up the, you know, to go through the process, and there's no real penalty if you skip it. So a lot of doctors don't recognize vaccine injury. They have an incentive not to report it, because they just gave your kid the shot, and they said it's going to save his life. And if instead he's in a wheelchair or crippled, they don't really want to acknowledge it was the vaccine. They just say that happened. So that happened. That kind of non-reporting is epidemic. So but nevertheless, there have been 17,000 deaths reported to VAERS on the COVID vaccines, and that's more deaths in the last 8 months than all of the deaths from all vaccines, the billions and billions of vaccines combined over the past 30 years. So this vaccine appears to be killing more people than all vaccines combined. There's more reports of deaths following vaccination. Here's the problem, is that the VAERS system doesn't work. It is designed, in fact, to fail. It's designed to undercount injuries by as much as 99%. Why do I say that? Because HHS did a study on the system in 2010. People can look it up. It's called Lazarus et al. And they published it, and they spent millions of dollars on this study, and they looked at one HMO. And what they did is they designed a machine counting system. How does a machine counting system work? Well, you take the HMO, has all the deaths, has all the records of all the medical claims of all their patients, and they have the vaccine records down to batch number. So every vaccine that patient took, they know. So it's quite easy to use AI to do a cluster analysis and compare whether people who got this batch of this vaccine are getting more diabetes or autism or ADD or rheumatoid arthritis or autoimmune disease, whatever. You can do it in an instant. So they designed a system like that, and they used it on the Harvard Pilgrim HMO in Boston. And then they compared it to what VAERS was getting. And what they found was that that the vaccine injuries were actually very, very common. They were happening in about 1 out of every 40 people per vaccine. And that VAERS was missing more than 99%. So the conclusion of that study is fewer than 1% of vaccine injuries are reported. Now, the interesting thing is they have that machine counting system, and they were going to roll it out to all the other HMOs. But when CDC saw the results, the frightening, alarming results, they killed that study. And they refused to answer the phone calls of Lazarus and his team. And Lazarus and his team were, you know, they were people from Harvard, and they were members of another health agency that is also within HHS. So CDC stopped talking to its fellow agency because it didn't like the news they were trying to get. It's called the Agency for Health Research Quality, the AHRQ. And how do I know this? Because if you look up the Lazarus study, the last lines in it say, CDC, when we showed them the results, they were very proud that they had done this. And CDC showed them when they showed the results to CDC, they said the CDC officials in charge of this project refused to answer our phone calls afterwards. So they just shut them down because they saw something that they did not want the public to know about vaccine safety.
It's horrifying.
So in the book, you, and even in the title of the book, you make the connection between Tony Fauci and Bill Gates. So for our viewers who are not familiar with that connection, can you give us a sense of what it is and why it matters?
In 2000, Tony Fauci flew out to Seattle, Washington, and he had this meeting, this very strange meeting Bill Gates' $85 million mansion on the banks of Lake Washington. And Gates brought him into his library, and he said, I want to propose a partnership with you. And the partnership was to try to vaccinate all of humanity. And they ended up calling that, in 2009, they rechristened the program the Decade of Vaccines. Gates went to the UN and gave this speech in which he promised to vaccinate essentially all of humanity with a multiple battery of vaccines by 2020. And he began using his philanthropy to create a series of other quasi-governmental agencies, CEPI, Gavi, and a number of others, and then to gain control of the WHO. And what he calls what he does philanthrocapitalism. It's not about philanthropy. It's about enriching the capitalists. What he does is he buys, and he does this in a number of areas I show in the book. He does it with food. He did it with the core curriculum. He buys large stakes in companies that could benefit from a change in governmental policies, a worldwide change in governmental policies. So he owns stakes, very, very large stakes, in almost all the big pharmaceutical companies. Then he gives essentially about $1 billion to WHO every year, but through Rotary International, through Gavi, through CEPI, and through the Gates Foundation. But they're sort of cumulatively even larger than the U.S., which is the second biggest. That gives him control over WHO's policy. So there, you know, the analysis of WHO say there is nothing that goes through WHO that is not vetted first by the Gates Foundation. And WHO controls the HIV money, and it funds the health agencies at most African countries. So they are completely reliant on those annual checks from WHO. And what Gates and WHO do, or WHO at Gates' behalf, because a lot of people in WHO do not want to do this, he's taken them away from their traditional occupations, which was economic development, hygiene, food supply, food production, and local democracy and local control. So WHO does very little of those things now, and they really focus, over 50% of their budget focuses on one of Gates' vaccine, one only, the polio vaccine, which is a flawed vaccine. The polio vaccine, according to WHO's own number, causes 70% of the polio on Earth every year. So it's not a successful vaccine, but what he does then is through WHO, WHO will go in and say to the African country, if you want your annual check from us, here's what you've got to do. You have to show an 80% uptake of the DTP vaccine. The DTP vaccine we don't use in white countries. The United States, that's the vaccine that was killing one out of every 300 kids. We got rid of it. The Europeans got rid of it. But Gates gives 161 million African children that vaccine every year. And what he'll say is, the WHO will say to this country, you don't get your HIV money, you don't get your systems money to run your health agency unless you can show us that you've vaccinated 80% of your kids. And that's a hypothetical number, but it will be something like that with the DTP vaccine. Then they get so those countries then are forced to buy that vaccine, and that vaccine, they have to purchase it ultimately from one of the companies that Gates is heavily invested in. And Gates is all, you know, so what he has a $33 billion corpus that he's put in the Gates Foundation, but it's still his money. He's still controlling it. And it's now tax deductible. Is shielded from taxes, and he is now deploying it to change government policies in a way that enriches companies that he's elsewhere invested in. And he does the same thing with food. He switched millions and millions of Africans from subsistence farming that they've been doing successfully for, 10,000 generations, to GMO crops, to heavily, lots of inputs, chemical agriculture, carbon-based fertilizers that all have to be imported by his companies. He has huge investments in Monsanto, in Cargill, and then in the processed food companies that are then buying those commodities cheap, like Coca-Cola, McDonald's, and Kraft cheese, those kind of things. So the more you look at it, the more corrupt it gets. But his deal with Tony Fauci, which I go into in detail, what the result, the outcome for that bargain on the lives of and health of millions and millions of Africans and South Asians has been absolutely catastrophic.
Not to get to motive, this is an exhaustively reported book that I can't recommend strongly enough. But I have to ask, what do you think motivates, apart from the profit motive that you just explained? It does seem to be an ideological fervor behind these vaccination campaigns. Like, it seems there's a religious quality to it.
There's a quality to it, right, to the orthodoxy. There, what motivates it is pretty simple, which is power, which is motivated. Bad behavior and good behavior since the human beings left Eden, right? In fact, that's why we got kicked out of Eden.
I know,
right?
Yes.
So that's, it's not a mystery that people want to accumulate power. Bill Gates is not interested in money in terms of currency. He's not sitting there, making big piles of bills. People accumulate money so that they can have power over their lives, over their environment, over their health, their food, but ultimately over other people. And some, if you're a sociopath or even people who are very, very well motivated, want to have power because they believe that they have a unique opportunity or unique ability to improve people's lives. So whatever, one thing I don't do, 2,200 footnotes in that book. Everything is cited and sourced. And what I do is I show conduct. I do not try to look into people's
heads. I noticed that. But
you were asking about the orthodoxy, and you know, you and I actually talked about this at another time. That orthodoxy is why do people have this religious fervor when it comes to vaccine? Why can't I sit down with my friends, my liberal friends, and have a fact-based conversation? Why do I have to be silenced? Why do people consider me dangerous? So that you're taking a huge risk by putting me on this show. You know, why can't we do what, you know, you're supposed to do in a democracy, which is to have, you know, ultimately to find common ground with people who disagree with you, to love your enemy, to have fact-based debates and, you know, that are congenial and that are, that maybe can resolve and maybe not resolve issues. And instead, anybody who tries to talk about these things runs into something that looks like an old-style medieval religious orthodoxy, which is, you know, the repetition of these shibboleths, follow the science, protect granny, you know, stop being selfish, and a total unwillingness to talk about facts, a total unwillingness, an imperviousness to factual argument. And not only that, but it's just a ferocious anger that you are dangerous because you have a different point of view than I do. And, you know, that kind of orthodoxy has occurred throughout time. You know, we are kind of designed to embrace orthodoxy we're hardwired for orthodoxy from the, you know, 20,000 generations. Our race spent wandering the African savannah in tiny groups, you know, following a powerful leader at war with all of our neighbors and, you know, having to embrace as a unit cohesion through a uniform cosmology, and anybody on the out group was evil and dangerous, and anybody on the in group, no matter how badly behaved they were, they had to be defended. And it's tribalism writ large, and that's what we're looking at. You know, we're looking at this polarization and tribalism, and I believe a lot of that is strategic. You know, and what I try to do is completely divorce myself from the politics and talk to Republicans and Democrats, because I think what we're seeing now is this imposition of these controls that have benefited these elites. You know, there's 500 new billionaires since the lockdown started. There's been a shift of $3.8 trillion in wealth from working people globally to, you know, this top rung of billionaires, most of them Silicon Valley people, or, you know, from this communications grid, you know, who are, by the way, tied to the intelligence agencies through a variety of you know, different entanglements. But, you know, it's Gates, it's Larry Ellison, it's Sergey Brin from Google, it's Mark Zuckerberg, it's Bloomberg, the mainstream, and social media. And the weird thing that people don't seem to see is that these people who are cashing in with hundreds of billions from the lockdowns are the same people who are censoring criticism of the lockdowns. And
kind of a closed loop there, isn't it?
It's a closed loop. And the best thing for them is if the Republicans and Democrats are fighting with each other and blacks and whites are fighting, right, and the polarization and the anger and the, you know, the bitterness at the ground level is occurring and nobody is noticing. They are feeding on the corpses of our obliterated middle class and gorging themselves.
I'm pulling back from pounding my fist on the table in agreement. I guess the upside of this sad moment is people's minds have gotten open to the point where they can hear what you're saying, which I think is absolutely provably true. So in the book, you use the phrase coup d'etat against liberal democracy repeatedly, worked me into a frenzy as I was reading it. Explain, if you would, what you meant by that.
Well, you know, and I mentioned this a little earlier, we've really seen the systematic demolition of our Bill of Rights, okay? And, you know, it's literally like it's systematic. And James Madison, John Adams, and Thomas Jefferson all said, we put freedom of speech in the First Amendment because if a government can, you know, if they can get rid of that one, then they have a license to take all, to commit any kind of atrocity they want. If you can't criticize them, they're going to destroy you. They're going to expand their power till there's nothing left for you. Freedom of speech, they, you know, I mean, why am I, nobody ever has been able to point to a single misstatement I ever made on Instagram. You know, everything, we put a huge amount at children's health events, huge amounts of resources into fact-checking, more than any, as far as I can tell, any other, now, you know, any other publication. We have on our board a Nobel Prize winner who discovered the HIV virus in 1993, the former head of the National Toxicity Program, on our advisory, scientific advisory board, 312 PhD scientists and MDs, and they look at what we're doing, and we fact check it rigorously. We have an entire team that does that. Everything I ever put on Instagram was sourced to a government database or to a peer-reviewed publication, but I got thrown off for vaccine misinformation because that term does not have anything to do with whether it's factually correct or not. It's simply a euphemism or anything that departs from government proclamations and, you know, corporate profit taking. If you threaten those things, then you are passing on misinformation. So anybody who wanted to criticize the government, they got rid of. That's why we had the revolution, so that we could criticize the government. Yes. And we put that first, and yet it's gone. Then the next thing they go after, the other half of the First Amendment, freedom of religion. They close every church in this country for a year, and they keep the liquor stores open. Well, by the way, without any hearing, without showing any science, without notice and comment rulemaking, no discussion, no debate. They keep the liquor stores open as essential businesses. Now, I have no problem with that, but with keeping the liquor stores open. But the liquor stores are not in the Constitution. The churches are. And, you know, and you, we shouldn't be able to close those lightly without having a debate about it. Then they go after property rights. They close a million businesses without due process or just compensation. That's a violation of the Constitution. They get rid of jury trials, the Sixth and Seventh Amendment. Here's what the Seventh Amendment says. No American shall be deprived of their rights to a trial before a jury of their peers in cases or controversies exceeding $25. That's it. It's the whole amendment. So there's no pandemic exception. There's no, and yet anybody now who claims to be doing a countermeasure, if you, it's not just the vaccine makers who you can't get a jury trial against if they kill you, but if you go into a hospital and you slip on a slippery floor that somebody negligently, you know, put bacon grease on, you can't sue for that. So, you know, anybody who's involved in this project, you can't sue. Jury trials have been abolished. They've gotten rid of the prohibitions against warrantless searches and seizures, and we're now all part of this, you know, track and trace surveillance state. And on and on. They literally have gotten rid of every amendment except, they've gotten due process law. Here's what due process says. If you want to pass a law in this country, if Congress passes it, okay. You know, we vote for Congress, we don't like it, we can vote them out. But if an agency passes it, they have to do certain things to make sure there's democracy involved. They have to I put a notice of the rulemaking. If published the proposed rule, They have to publish an environmental impact statement explaining all the science behind the proposed rules, citing the studies, citing their rationale, an economic impact statement showing how each person in society will get hurt, and a regulatory impact statement to make sure the costs meet the benefits. Then they have to have notice and comment. So we get 30 or 60 or 90 days where everybody sends in letters and says, this is gonna, for example, a guy could say, you know, I own a kayak company. I can't put masks on my clients because it could kill them if they fall over. So I should be exempted. So those are the kind of things you do with notice and comment, and the government has to respond. Have to narrowly tailor the rules so it only does what it's intended to do and doesn't affect other people. And then you have a public hearing where Tony Fauci could bring in his experts to say why masks work, why lockdowns work, why social distancing works. And we can, other people who oppose him can bring in theirs. And you have a case that's published and everybody watches it and then there's an appeals. None of that happened. It was just a doctor who has never treated a COVID patient, saying 1 week masks don't work, and a month later, everybody putting them on and not citing one study to justify that change. It was government by diktat. And so during that first year, we literally got rid of every amendment to the Constitution except the Second Amendment. It's the only one that's left. And, you know, what I tell people is, you know, we have to love our freedom more than we fear a germ. We have to. And, you know, even to, and I would even, you know, remind people that there's all that, even if this was the deadly disease that they say it is, there's worse things than death. And there was a whole generation, and that may sound cold, and people get mad at me for saying it, but we're lucky that there was a whole generation of Americans in 1776 who said it would be better to die than to not have these rights written down. And they gave us that. They gave us that gift of that Bill of Rights. And in 1 year, at the bidding of a doctor, because he's telling us, you know, you need to do this to save them, and orchestrated fear, and, you know, all of the weird stuff they did with the numbers, which is not what public health is supposed to be doing. In 1 year, all of those rights have been taken away from us. And, you know, we the Democrats and Republicans need to stop fighting each other, and we need to start fighting the bad guys. The people who are taking away everything we value, everything. There's no such thing as Republican children, Democratic children. You know, and our kids deserve to have the same Bill of Rights that our parents gave us. And people need, whatever their fears are, they need to put those aside and, you know, and demand that we get those things back.
I think it's a really moving summation. It's not just, and we could go on forever, but just sum it up for us. This is not just a domestic phenomenon, the old system being swept away because of COVID. I mean, this is, you describe it in the book as the end of liberal democracy globally.
Right, and that, I think I do a job in that book that nobody's ever done before. And I think it will become clear to people when they read the last chapter of this book how this happened, how all of these liberal democracies across the globe pivoted simultaneously to obliterate constitutional, to have, as I said, a coup d'etat against democracy globally, and to impose totalitarian controls like nobody's ever experienced. People would sit around and say, how do they all know what to do at the exact same time? And I show that in this book exactly. They have been planning it for 20 years, and this is going to sound like paranoid and a conspiracy theory, but you know because you've read it that I document exactly what happened, names, dates, and, you know, the involvement of the really deep involvement of the intelligence agencies, of people from the bioweapons divisions of our militaries across the globe, you know, who are more aligned with China, the bioweapons developers, and China and the United States were more aligned and loyal to each other than they were to the nations that they're supposed to be defending. It's a very odd phenomenon, but I show how it happened meticulously. And I would urge people, just if you read nothing else, read the last chapter of that book. It's called Germ Games, and you will understand how your government turned against you.
Yeah, I read it last night and stayed up till 2 a.m. It upset me. I got to ask one last question that's not germane to any of this, but I just can't control myself because it's a subject of interest to me. So the Warren Commission, which was the commission that investigated the murder of your uncle in 1963 in Dallas, produced, you know, massive volume of paper. Nearly 60 years later, some of it is still classified. We just learned that it was supposed to be released years ago. It still hasn't been released. Given that virtually everyone directly involved is dead, why do you think those materials are still classified?
It is a mystery. I mean, clearly, as you and I talked about, it's not about... It can't be that they're protecting an individual. They have to be protecting institutions. But it's weird because, you know, I didn't agree with Trump on a lot of stuff, but Trump was willing. One of the things about him is he was willing to defy institutions and break things.
Yeah.
And he did not like the CIA. He promised he was going to release it.
I know.
And then he didn't. And, you know, I'd like, if I ever run into him again, I'm going to ask him, you know, why, what made you change? What did they tell you? What did they tell you that made you change your mind? And of course, you know, I have no idea what Biden's thinking on this, but they all promise they're going to release it, and then they all stop. And it's, you know, our country really took a turn at that point in history. And it's really important for Americans to really understand what happened. And, you know, the Warren Commission was a whitewash. I don't think any Americans, there's almost no Americans other than highly placed people in the New York Times who believe the Warren Commission, you know. And so I hope at some point, you know, we do find out something about the truth.
You think we will?
I don't know. I've given up making predictions, Tucker.
I just want to say it again. Of all the people who need to write a book like this, you're in last place. You had no reason to write this, but you did anyway. And I'm just really, really grateful for your bravery and the meticulousness of your research and your willingness to come on today. So thank you.
Thank you for your courage in having me on, because I haven't been on a TV show like this and. 15 years.
We didn't think twice. I was so impressed by it. Name of the book is The Real Anthony Fauci. Absolutely worth reading. Bobby Kennedy Jr., name of the guest. Tucker Carlson, today, the name of the show. New episodes every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday on Fox Nation. We'll see you every weeknight, 8 p.m. on the Fox News Channel.